Welcome to the Northern Business Podcast, a regular discussion with people in the north of England who lead businesses, employ people, and they have new ideas to help our economy grow. And we've got a very interesting new idea to tell you about today. The Northern Business Podcast is produced by Recognition PR, which serves scores of companies in different sectors across the country, some of which occasionally contribute to the programme. We're kindly sponsored by Vertu Motors, one of the top automotive retailers in the UK, with a network of dealerships representing some of the world's most popular brands. I'm Graham Lobb. In the studio today, we have Alex Hunter, who's the CEO at Sherwood Power. More about his innovation soon. Down the line, we have Patrick Glennon from Patrick James Solutions, and he's going to be talking to us about mortgage and the property market, which is developing at pace. And later in the episode, we'll be hearing from Dr. Ram Reichhaven, and Dr. Ram is the founder of Riddlebox, and he spoke to us about his journey and the company he uses to support SMEs in their future development. So, James and Alex, welcome to the Northern Business Podcast. And James, where are you? You're coming down the line. Where are you based?
Appleby.
Appleby in Cumbria.
Indeed.
Very nice. Well, we'll come to you in a minute because I want to hear all about the property market and where its impact is on our economy in general. But let's start with you, Alex, Patrick James. I should have said it was Patrick, not James. My first error on names. But Alex Hunter from Sherwood Power. Before we get into what you've been up to, tell us the innovation that you've been developing in the field of power generation.
So the innovation is a very ancient innovation. It's compressed air energy storage. In Germany, they have one, Hunsdorf, in Lower Saxony. It's been operational since 1976. It's still operational today.
Wow.
So what we've done is...
It's been going nearly 50 years.
Yeah, and if you go back over compressed air has been around for thousands of years. So we're taking an old technology, which is used in industry all over the world to power machines, to do automation. And we're using that storage technology to store electrical energy and give it back at two different price points. So we fill the system up when electricity is abundant and cheap, and then we give it back when it's expensive and rare.
So night storage heaters, but no heaters, just compressed air.
Ooh, I wouldn't say that. I think we have a number of different things that we can output. We can output cooling, heating, and also we can split gases. We can also absorb carbon dioxide.
Oh, well, that's even better. So tell us practically the kind of application that you're actually going to be selling this into.
So any industrial estate where there are a number of SMEs or there is a large off-taker of energy and that particular off-taker wants to be more self-sufficient, more self-reliant. We all saw what happened to Heathrow Airport. Mm-hmm. And if they'd had their systems correctly configured, there's no way that they would have been taken offline. And basically, it's the resilience piece, which says that if you've got a critical piece of infrastructure or a factory or a process, you want to be running 24/7, 365.
So the compressed air is driving a turbine, essentially, that produces consistent electricity.
Yep.
I suppose you could figure it like a battery without all the lithium and so on. It's a storage of power to power a turbine.
Yeah, we call it a FAB because I'm a big Thunderbirds fan. And FAB was their sign-off. We call it a free air bank.
Free air bank.
Right. And it's a bit like a bank because you deposit money when you've got lots of it and you take it out when you haven't got so much.
Yeah, and if you had a fire at a substation, then this could go on rather like having an emergency generator.
Exactly so, yeah.
So that's the concept. What obstacles so far have you had to bring it to the market?
We've been trying to court the VC market, venture capital market, since 2019. And we've found that the bar that's being set, because we're a high capital intensive infrastructure play, that not many VCs are particularly interested in that. They're more interested in software, which has got a lower capital threshold, and they can turn it around and flip it between 3 and 5 years. Mm. So we've found the barrier of getting access to finance quite irksome, I would say. And although there are specialist investors in the UK and Europe, we haven't managed to extract any coin from them just yet. Meanwhile, in China, they're pushing ahead in leaps and bounds with compressed air energy storage. And last year, they connected the largest ever in the world compressed air energy storage system, which is 1.8 gigawatt hours.
Fantastic. That's like a major power station.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about your trip to China recently, because you managed to persuade the Chinese to invest.
Indeed. So we started off in 2024 March with an engagement with a very reputable company in China. And through that process, we engaged with the local government who provide a power plant. Now, I thought power plant, I thought power station. It's not a power station per se. They have 10 industrial units where they're building silicon wafers. And at the center of those units, they have a central facility which provides electricity. Mm-hmm. It provides compressed air, vacuum, refrigeration, air conditioning, water, gas. Oh. And we're integrating into that asset to effectively time shift when compressed air is made and when it's consumed, and also time shift the electricity.
Now, the Chinese have taken net zero more seriously than maybe the jingle suggests. The sort of default position you hear in media discussions about China is that they're building a coal-fired power station every few days or what have you, and that the Chinese economy is contributing much of the carbon emissions. Now, that may be true, but there is another truth as well, which is that they are leading in the production of renewable energy. Tell us what you've discovered on your trip to China about that.
Yeah, installation-wise, 60% of the world's wind and solar is being installed in China. So the rest of the world put together, Europe, United States, and all the other countries of the world, 40%. They're moving at a rate of knots. They also understand that they need to balance that variable input. So they're exploring every single storage technology. So it's not just batteries and the likes of BYD and Qatar. Coming out of China, which are currently what's being installed in terms of storage. They're looking at every other type of storage because they realize that two-hour storage is not enough. They need something for a much longer duration than 2 hours.
So if you are looking at one of your bits of kit, what kind of length of, I suppose it's capacity and power, but if you are looking at a small business zone and a small business estate, are they going to run out of power in an hour, or is there going to be enough for a half a day? What kind of length of time are you looking at if they were average use?
Typical use would be anything from 1 to 10 megawatts and anything from 1 to 12 hours. And the typical is the 12-hour play. So we're taking daytime solar and marrying it with nighttime wind because our asset can charge and discharge at the same time, so we can still take on board fractionally priced electricity and charge it up.
Okay, so we talked about the investment needed to bring it to life. We talked about going and getting investment from China. But what about the market and the appetite from people to put these bits of kit into their businesses or their business parks? What's it going to take to crack that? Is there a price differential that needs to be ironed out?
So we can say the average business user, 40% of their electricity bill. And if you're a large user of electricity, that is significant.
The cost of entry, that might be a saving in day to day, but is there a large cost of entry by buying the kit?
Yeah, there is. There's a capital outlay, but the capital outlay repayment is within 3 to 4 years on current UK differentials. And the lifetime of our asset is 25 years.
That's very interesting. I remember when I put solar panels on my own house, we were talking about a differential of 6 to 12 years. Mm-hmm. So that is a very interesting bit of information. So is the stopping you getting it installed in Britain the fact that you have to make it and have to get the funds to produce the kit?
Absolutely, Rob. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. And it's quite a high hurdle rate. So we've managed to get 1.1 million from the Chinese government. That gets us our first of a kind. We have N number of companies. In fact, I have 53 inquiries, live inquiries at various stages of development. We want to see one. We want to see one in operation.
Yeah,
we want to kick the tires. We want to put an amp meter on the amount of electricity going in and the amount of electricity coming out. And yes, we want to know where all the energy is.
You wouldn't want to be the first person to buy an electric car without giving it a drive, would you?
Correct.
Okay, so now the question about China has to be asked. Chinese companies owe a duty to the state. That's the law in China. The state can ultimately, if there's a dispute, come down on the side of the state. The company has to do that. Are you entirely comfortable with taking Chinese money?
Yes, I am, because we need to move past this point of this very high barrier that we were walking into the whole time. And we've tried very, very hard to raise that money through grants here in the UK. I've got a lot. Well,
and investment, as you were saying.
Yeah, and investment, and investments. And I think the hurdle rate is just too high. And most people, if I'm brutally honest, if you say, how do you store electricity? They'll give you a reply, which you gave at the start of this interview, which is battery.
Yes. Yeah.
Chemical battery.
Yeah.
But if you look at the total round cost, life cost of a chemical battery, from raw material extraction right the way through to disposal, and bear in mind there are only about 3% of batteries actually recycled at the moment. We've got a huge problem coming.
Yeah, and people do ignore, and with the electric cars coming on board, you can see this as well, that they do ignore the ecological downside of battery production. So look, one last thing. You've gone to China, you've got investment in China, but you're also looking at other developing and now seriously large economies like India. We've just got a British trade deal with India. Is that going to open up the market for you, do you think?
It absolutely will, yes. And I have to, although we didn't manage to raise money in terms of the capital that we required, Innovate UK have been absolutely brilliant in supporting us in outreach programs to get to these markets. And we wouldn't be as far ahead as we are now without that support. So you have to balance both sides.
Well, we look forward to seeing the first of your plants in operation with the compressed air pushing out the turbine. That would be fantastic to go and film and watch it.
Yeah, sure.
The light bulb moment, almost literally.
Yeah, yeah.
Alex, hold that thought. Let's come back to you a little bit before we wrap.
Absolutely.
Can we bring in Patrick? Patrick is from Patrick James Solutions, Patrick Glennon. Now, entirely different subject, Patrick, though fascinating though that was. When it comes to day-to-day living, there you are, helping people to find a home, to purchase a home. Tell us a little bit about your business. Give us everyone a little overview of what you do.
So I'd like to say that we just make buying a home easier for those that need a mortgage. And I think at the moment in our industry, we're looking at 97% of all mortgages are actually by a broker rather than direct with the bank. So when you think of that kind of capacity that we're taking on, without us, without our expertise, everyone who's looking at buying a home or even has a home is kind of going to need our services. So we're a big part of the industry and big part of that purchase cycle.
There was a report this week suggesting that only 1 in 10 people under 44 years old can afford their first home, and that's particularly bad in London. And the actual house price gap continues. The economy is not doing brilliant at the moment, but the house prices are still roaring ahead. So this question of affordability, which has been raised by the House Builders Federation, Home Builders Federation, how are you seeing it play out as you get customers through the front door organising their mortgages?
Well, today, when you ask that question, I've got a kind of positive answer. If we'd have spoke about this 6 months ago, no one seemed to know how we were going to approach this, what we're going to do. Now, the government are in talks with the regulator, positive talks, which is a rare thing for a mortgage advisor to admit and say. But in terms of affordability, they are reviewing this. It's across the board. We're speaking to lenders almost on a daily basis, where the affordability, the stress testing, and just the realization that you have to do something about this. Last time I was a guest on here, we talked about the average house price. Now, obviously, we've got to understand that the average house price isn't the average first-time buyer either. Now, in London, absolutely, I agree with you. There's so many helping hands out there from the lenders whereby they allow people who are struggling with affordability to bring in other areas that could support them, be it a parent, be it a specialist product, a professional occupation, and again, enhanced affordability. So already, even since MMR in 2014, they're able to lend 15% of their book to a higher affordability Now, that's not easy to do. And it's also the people at the higher end need that stretch too. But the government are in talks with the regulator, with the right people, in order to give the lenders a little bit more power and leeway to lend more.
And is the block, from your point of view, the kind of reform you're looking for, to make it a little bit more reactive to real world situations? In the last few years, there has been a relatively crude affordability test that is computer driven. You put your numbers in and computer says yes or computer says no.
Absolutely. Even the way you've just described that's exactly right. We've been frustrated because there has been bigger issues in the world. We get that. But in terms of the mortgage market, to fix it, if they listen to brokers, because we, again, do 97% of the business, we would have the right answers. And we're not doing that for greed. We're just seeing a lot of customers have to either make do or do things that maybe you didn't have to do 20, 30 years ago. So the right things are easy to achieve, and it's just a bit of common sense. And it seems that they're now putting that into play. And of course, they've had some distractions. We've had a change of government, and that's not easy. But even the things like stamp duty, everything that they're doing is a little bit predictable, and it's now happening. And I believe since 2008, we've got more mortgage products in the market than back then. So we've now got more mortgage products that were available than in 2008, when obviously there was a hell of a lot there.
So let's talk about, just drill down this very niche point about affordability. Give us a tangible example of maybe a young couple, whether on a first or second house. I'm not talking about an older person getting a big luxury house, but a regular couple or single person trying to buy a house. What kind of affordability test would you like to see eliminated? And what would that mean to the way the system works better?
So moving with the standard, you may have heard it, hopefully you have 4.5 times income. Okay, that's kind of like the go-to. If someone said, how much can we borrow? If you were to be lazy or just to give a vague figure, 4.5 times. When you put that to the average house price of 271, it's not going to work with someone who's just coming out of coming into employment, even from university. Mm. It is not going to work, but it hasn't changed. The stress test that were put in place on the back of the last crash in 2008 with MMR in 2014, what they did was they built in a stress testing, which was very much looking at what would happen in a cost of living crisis. So when it happened, why a lot of people didn't lose their homes or struggled to pay their mortgages or ended up in arrears was because these mortgages with 1% rates or 2% rates, they were already stress tested. Mm-hmm. Mortgage is the most important thing, and people will always put that first. Probably then, obviously, you've got your lifestyle. But when bills do go through the roof, the lenders are prepared for that. But what they haven't done is, instead of evolve that and rely on that safety net they built in, was realized that actually incomes are going up. House prices are always going up. We need to do something about it. And I think that they wanted to, but the regulator and obviously the government held them back a little bit because of the fear of what did go wrong, not necessarily here, but across the pond. And I think they've just tried to be a bit overcautious, whereas now we're seeing it relax a little bit, and fingers crossed at the end of the year, we'll have some better.
The interesting point is that the caution did not stop price rises going up. So house prices going up. So the worry you'd have is if you're suppressing the amount that people can borrow and the house prices are still going up, what happens if you take your foot off it? What happens if you relax the rules? Won't they go up even more? Won't there be a massive explosion?
You would think that that would happen. In terms of mortgage approvals, mortgage products, they're already there. We're very busy on the first-time buyer, whether it be kind of first-time buyers, individuals, or just people looking to purchase their own home as a stepping stone, with or without support from the family. We've always been busy. That's just a generation thing, and it will come round. Where we're really busy, and this is the main concern, and it's a common question to get asked about people getting on the ladder. We've got 1.8 million people coming up for renewal this year.
Yeah,
that's 400,000 more than last year, and it's 600,000 more than the average year. Now, that's because of what happened in COVID. obviously with the low house prices, the stamp duty. And then 2 years ago, what happened when mortgage rates went through the roof? People took a 2 year. So we've got a 5 and a 2 year cohort coming into play this year. So actually there's 1.8 million people that have already got a mortgage, gone on the property ladder, that need that attention and need that service, as well as the first time buyers. So I think that people will still knock on my door and ask for advice, and I'll either say yes or no. I'm not seeing a downward trend in the people we can help. If anything, I think we're very good at being able to do that. It's the education. Speak to a broker first, then go house hunting.
Yes, because you then know how much you've got to spend, and it's much easier to look at the right house. And Patrick, when it comes to the interest rates that are being remortgaged to this cohort of 2 million or so, they've got to remortgage. Very, very few people will be remortgaging into an interest rate environment that's lower. They'll almost all be mortgaging into an interest environment that's higher, won't they?
Yeah, so if you look at that as a proportion, exactly right. You've got the 5-year fixes that came off people who had booked in and locked in those 1% for potentially 5 years. But we are seeing off the back end, bearing in mind we speak to customers 6 months before the deal comes to an end, those that happen in October 23, we're saving them a hell of a lot of money because they locked in when they had to. There was a very small window when rates went up, and if they had left it too late, which you used to, because there was no need to be speaking to a mortgage advisor 7 months out, and they had to, unfortunately, take a rate or pay a variable, which was even higher. So it's not a great thing to be saving them money because it is a little bit blindsided because the rate was so high in the first place. But no, we are seeing a bit of both. And for a first-time buyer, they haven't had a rate previously. I think rates are relatively okay. I'd like them to be better. I'm a homeowner. But it's about affordability. We don't even discuss a rate with a customer when they're first looking for a home. We talk budget. And if you talk on monthly payment, we can forget the rate. We can look at the affordability, the house, the purchase price, the deposit, what they can do to achieve a better, higher deposit, where their thresholds are. And that's where the conversation starts. Everyone wants to chase the rate, but actually that's not the most important thing, certainly not at the moment.
All right. My last question to you. Inflation today came in at 3.5%, much higher than analysts were predicting. Everyone said it would chip up a bit, and you've got different commentators, depending on where their stance is, saying this is a blip or this is set in. Underlying inflation on all of the other stuff, core inflation, was much higher than that, 4.5%. So my question to you, you're in the market, I'm going to put you on the spot. Do you think that mortgage rates and interest rates have come down and that's going to be it for a few months? Or does this lower trajectory look like it will continue?
So we've got Charlotte who's employed by me, and I always put her on the spot. And I joke with my customers, for the last 2 years, I've not been right. I've taken a tracker mortgage myself previously, expecting rates to come down in the whole 24 months, they never moved. No one can get it right. No one can claim to either. I like to think Charlotte's got a magic ball, and we always put her on the spot, and she's not been wrong. We think, as a company, we think that rates are going to keep doing what they're doing. They're going to have a little bit of a settle period. The base rate dropped obviously recently, and we'll have a couple more months of just a plateau. And then hopefully we can assess it based on not just 1 month's inflation. We can look at the bigger picture. There's a lot of business that can be made in terms of people buying properties, and that can help the economy. And I think if we do kickstart the economy by inflation being reduced, we're going to see a bit of an uplift every now and again. It's never going to be a straight line from top left to bottom right. And I think we just need to be patient, not react to it too quickly.
All right. Thank you very much, Patrick. How do you feel about the economy at the moment, Alex? I know you're focused on your product, but the economy is the real world you have to put it into.
Yeah, the economy is, I think, in the West, suppressed, but it's certainly not suppressed. And the markets we're playing in, they're both markets are expanding. And if you go to the East, it's interesting, as soon as Trump put tariffs up, first thing that Chairman Xi did was go around his local neighbours. So he went to Malaysia, he went to Vietnam, which are their biggest trading partners. So I think there's a shift in world economics at the moment, and I think that shift is East.
Well, that's very interesting. Alex, Patrick, thank you. We're going to turn something else down. We're going to hear from Dr. Ram Rangadhaven, and he recently shared his journey with his complete riddle box and outlined his future plans for growth.
Thanks, Graham. Joining me today is Dr. Ram Raghavan from Riddlebox. We're going to talk a little bit about what is Riddlebox and how it helps the performance of SMEs. So, Dr. Ram, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. So what is Riddlebox and how does it benefit SMEs?
Okay, Riddlebox is basically a collection of tools, business tools, where it empowers founders to regain control of their scaling business, turning burnout and operational chaos into sustainable growth. And it's all about building momentum. It was built on my PhD thesis, where I've actually used it to help companies like, can I say the name of the companies? I don't know.
Yes, please do. If you're
like Hilton and Volvo across EMEA, where we have used our proprietary AI and behavioral algorithms and tools to deliver actionable results, insights, and guided strategies. And what I've done is I've taken that and simplified it, because for a bigger company, challenges are different. So I've simplified it to the needs of SMEs and growing businesses so that they can apply it and scale their business with confidence and clarity. So that's what we do. We have a set of tools which can be used by SMEs to understand the challenges and then address them instantly.
So is this a bit like for like an SME that's needing some support, you know, for accountancy or needing support for HR, that they can outsource this? Is this like outsourcing to consultants to help you grow your business?
In a way, yes. See, a journey of an entrepreneur is always long, hard, and lonely. And you have to think of wear multiple hats and do multiple things. And what happens as a result is when you start then getting into the gray phase where you're trying to grow, you tend to do multiple things. So time, which is a precious resource, gets consumed very quickly. So you resort to tools, then you end up having a lot of tools. And then you start doing multiple things because people have tried it. And you end up with the chaotic scenario. So then what really happens is either it overwhelms the founder or the team, and there's a lack of clarity, which means they're not able to move forward. And the biggest killer for a startup or a scale-up business is momentum or the lack of it. What we do is basically bring clarity around that. We get them to look at three things, because in business, you need only these three things. You need to have a strategy. Be clear on what you're trying to do, who's your customer, what are the pain points, gain points. And then if you have an employees, or if you're the employee, try and find a way to execute it. Now, having a great strategy and great team is not enough. You need to have customers. So understanding your customers, what they want, and then offering it in a way that your employees can deliver, then makes the whole thing simple. So it's just focusing on these three legs using the tools, but it brings immense clarity. It clutters all the noise out of the equation.
So one of the things we're told about in the economy at the moment is that best way to improve it in the situation, this ever-changing situation we're in, but not a particularly positive one in some ways, is to improve productivity. It's always the argument. If we're more productive, then the economy can grow. So give us, how do you think an SME can improve performance being supported by your type of technology?
See, I'm actually a person who's always the glass is half full. So I see this as an opportunity. And see, well, productivity, when people talk about productivity, there are a lot of things that, I mean, you have gurus who talk about productivity. There is so much literature out there. And we're doing everything we can. But still, the UK's productivity has not gone up. Global productivity is going down. Why? Because a lot of SMEs are trying to be in the business by being busy. So it's more of a busyness rather than a business. And as I mentioned before, time is the killer and lack of momentum is the second one. So by understanding what and where you spend your time matters most. So that impacts productivity, and we can actually help people understand where the time is wasted. And then understanding what you can do differently as a result makes a lot of sense. And productivity deals on two things. One is what I call as the mechanics, and the second one is the humanics. It is the process that you have in place, which you execute, or you expect your team to execute. There might be bottlenecks, there are frictions there. And then you have the people challenges. By understanding what your friction points are, and finally, a lot of businesses tend to ignore the friction points. They actually try to find a workaround. And as a business owner, you try to tend to take those shortcuts. You think, oh, I can skirt around it and then move and come back to it later. that basically kills productivity big time. You have, and people subscribe to a lot of tools. I would probably bring it down to one or two or three things that really matter. So going back and answering your question, for a productivity to go up in the SME side, SME owners have to be really, really, really focused. And they need to start looking at what is really measurable. What, see, you measure a lot of things because you know you can measure it, but is it actually relevant? So forget vanity metrics. Focus on one thing. So for example, if you're a startup founder, I would focus on customer acquisition. How many people are actually using my platform? If it's a tech solution, if it is an offline solution, how many customers am I actually offering this product or service? If I am a scale-up founder, I would look at what can I do to address the customer acquisition cost? What are my bottlenecks? What is the customer experience? So looking at something which is very, very clear from a business perspective and working your way backwards to what you do is what I would do. Normally, what we do is we do it the other way around. No, we have employees, so we'll measure them, we'll train them on this, we'll actually bring productivities, we'll give OKRs. Lot of things happen. And that's where creation happens. If you look at it from a neurological perspective, we don't like complexity. We are lazy. And the brain is actually hardwired to either fight or flight. So when you overwhelm people with a lot of suggestions, this and that, and then shifting goalposts, and then in a SME scenario, it's chaos always. Right from the time you wake up to the time you go to bed, it's chaos. If you bring that chaos back into the workforce or the in your workplace, that energy then percolates down the line and it creates confusion and a lot of things fall between the gaps. In fact, I run some free productivity clinics every week. But and specifically, funny today, we have a session where we are going to be talking about exactly this topic on productivity and what SMEs can do differently to address that. Hopefully that answered your question.
Yeah, fantastic. No, it certainly did. Dr. Ram, thank you very much for joining us on Northern Business Podcast. It's been fascinating talking to you and good luck with the business.
Jamie Collis there talking to Dr. Ram Raghavan. Well, if you'd like to join us as a guest on the Northern Business Podcast, feel free to get in touch, use LinkedIn or contact Recognition PR. Thanks to our podcast producer, Alex Dryden, and to our technical operator, Robin Campbell. Do join us again on the Northern Business Podcast.